Unreal. Uncensored. Unradio.
CliffCentral.com.
And Unshaken on this earthquake tremor day in Joburg. Welcome to Greg Nicholson joining us in the studio today. I'm your host, Didi Sharalambos. We're doing the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central today, talking about current affairs, news, and things affecting the country and the continent and the world. And in the Daily Maverick sphere of influence, we're starting off today talking about the documentary Miners Shot Down. This is a piece Greg did today on Daily Maverick that was published today, talking about the documentary by Rehad Desai that's received some critical acclaim around the world, actually, and been awarded South Africa, Best Documentary at the South African Film Festival recently in Durban. And a call for this documentary to be shown on free-to-air television and more places than just, you know, the DSTVs of the world and the cinemas, which have restricted access effectively for a lot of people to see this movie.
Steely, let me, that's right. I think first of all, what we should do is I'll give you a bit of an introduction to the movie for some of the people who haven't been able to see it, who haven't been to Cinema Nouveau or got to see a free screening and who only have ETV and SABC. And sorry for those people out there. But the movie is quite striking. It might help to explain its impact by saying when I went to see it with my girlfriend and another friend of ours, both of them were crying throughout the movie. Quite, and not just tearing, you know, not just a little bit and not just, you know, not just here and there. They were crying throughout most of the movie, properly crying, and that was true for most of the cinema. It really, really has a strong impact. Rehad Desai, who is a documentary filmmaker and he directed this film, he's closely linked with the Marikana mine workers, and in his documentary, which is 86 minutes long, He starts with looking at the 6 days to the August 16 killings where 34 mine workers were gunned down by police and killed and another, I think, 75-odd were shot and injured. But the way he does it is what has such an impact. It's not just a documentary of events over those 6 days as to what happened. What he does beautifully well and with an incredible film score and beautiful visuals is he somehow captures how Marikana is such a symbolic event for post-apartheid South Africa. It's not just the killing of mine workers or not just a random incident of tragic deaths. It says something greater about the country and since where we've come since 1994 as the first post-apartheid massacre. It's a symbol of ongoing inequality. It's a symbol of political patronage and capitalism exploiting the working class. And it's a symbol of that not enough has changed since 1994, and some of our struggle leaders, such as Cyril Ramaphosa, who's featured quite a bit in the film, it seems like they've lost their values, and that's why it's so powerful. So far, it's only been aired on DSTV and in some cinemas, but not widely aired. And there's this new group called Amandla.mobi, and they've put together a petition, which is online, and it's also going through, you can use any cell phone to sign up to it. And their idea is that they want to get it screened on ETV and SABC on the 16th of August, the 2-year anniversary of the Marikana massacre, just so we can have the information out there so that people can know what happened. And even if Rehad does take a bit of an activist bent, they can see and at least get the information for themselves to make up their own mind about what happened.
Well, it's incredible to think that it's 2 years now. I mean, you know, it seems like yesterday on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, the commission and the drive to get to the bottom of this just seems to be this never-ending story. How are things at the commission? You know, where is the commission? You know, what is the expected timeline for any sort of outcome? And what do you think the outcome will be?
The commission is a never-ending story. I think it gets extended and extended and extended again. But now they've set a final date, and I don't think they're going to extend it after this, which is the end of September. So at the moment, lately we've seen, last week we saw some testimonies from Lonmin security guards, and there were some interesting things that came out of that. For example, there were some of the security guards in the days leading up to the 16th when there were clashes with the mine workers, security, some clashes with police, some clashes with the NUM. The Lonmin security did fire on some of these workers. I'm not sure if it was rubber bullets or what. I can't remember the exact detail. But what was quite interesting is that the logbooks, where they're supposed to record everything, you know, when they fire their weapons, the logbooks submitted to the commission and the logbook that was in Lonman's possession are different. The Lonman logbook says they shot. at these mine workers. Mm. The one at the commission says they didn't.
Mm. So and obviously it's a cover up. Obviously, an omission, you know, a mistake, I think is what they called it, a regrettable omission on their part.
It's easy to do, I guess. Just forget about trying to shoot someone.
Tell me about the efforts to get miners shot down onto the free-to-air stations and sort of the plight and some of the work you've done to find out, you know, where it is, what is the possibility of getting it out there?
Yeah, for me, one of the most interesting things is I spoke to the head of genre at SABC last night. And she, her job is to actually, they look at all a broad range of things that get sent to them and, you know, the people want aired on SABC. And they choose. They say, okay, let's have this. And this could go well on SABC 1, 2, or 3. So then they send that, that film or documentary or whatever it is to those channels. And then they choose. And what she actually said about Miners Shot Down was, her division said they liked it and they've sent it to SABC 2. And now it's their decision as to what they're going to do with it. But, what SABC had told Rihad Desai, the director, previously was that there are no free slots to air anything until 2015. And so that didn't seem very likely. And he sort of seems to think as well, and I think a lot of us do, that the government wouldn't like it to be aired on free-to-air television because it does implicate, you know, quite a few state officials. You've got Cyril Ramaphosa, you've got National Police Commissioner Rio Pieja, and so on.
If only there was an independent broadcaster that we could turn to.
If only.
Yeah, if only.
But there's also, actually, I should mention ETV too, which is quite interesting, because ETV doesn't have the same sort of political drive behind its decisions, you know. ETV doesn't have to go out there and have Claudio Mazzoneng, you know, protecting Zuma. So the question is, why aren't they going to air it? And there's a bit of dispute as to that. So the ETV people told me yesterday that, first of all, they have their own documentaries. Did you see their documentary after the 1 year, Through the Lens?
Yeah, Maricano? Through the Lens, yeah.
What did you think?
Yeah, look, it's probably not going to, you know, it's not going to stack up to Miner Shot Down. But, you know, at least something was done, right?
That's
the point. They went and created the program, produced the program themselves and ran it, you know? So, you know, I guess on the one hand, it is encouraging that, the story is being told. Yeah, it's just not going to have, you know, not the same budgets or the same kind of input and, you know, influence that Miner Shot Down would have.
That's right. And Miner Shot Down does, we should say that it does have quite an activist bent to it. It does, Rihad Desai wants to make change. He wants to get the charges against the arrested mine workers dropped. Mm. He wants to raise money for the families of the victims. He wants to make sure that the Falun Commission actually holds these sort of people to account. And that's one of the different things, I think, between the ETV documentary and his. The ETV was trying to be quite objective, where he's sort of going from quite a certain position and a certain slant.
Yeah, and that activist slant is going to come through in the message, right? And in, you know, in the emotive play on people's heartstrings in producing all those scenes. So where to from here? I mean, is there any likelihood it's going to get? I mean, SABC, we can probably write that off, right?
Well, we'll see. Maybe SABC will put it on in 2015, 2016 or something like that. I'm not sure if they're the fastest moving, broadcaster, but there is mounting pressure. Like I mentioned with this group, Amandla.mobi, and you can go to their website. It's just Amandla.mobi and sign a petition to try and get, the documentary shown on these TV channels. So it doesn't seem like anything's going to happen. Definitely not for this anniversary of Maracana. Mm-hmm. But I still wouldn't be surprised if at some point one of these broadcasters used it. There seems to be a bit of a problem and misunderstanding between Rihad and the guys at ETV, because you'd think that they would want to use that because it's actually a very good documentary, but there seems to be a bit of misunderstanding as to whether there's been an offer or there hasn't been an offer, but I can't see in the foreseeable future that it's going to be used, but who knows with this sort of petition group, they're actually trying to build sort of a mass campaign behind this issue. And the reason that they're social campaigners, the reason they got on this issue is quite interesting. It's because one of the mine workers, one of the deceased mine workers' wives, she specifically said she wants this film to be shown to the public. She wants the public to see what happened. And she knows that most of the public, just like her, you know, people from the Eastern Cape, people, you know, mine workers in the Northwest, they watch ETV and they watch SABC. And so that's why this group got involved. Yeah. So we'll see if any sort of mass organization and mobilization builds behind this, and then they might even plan to march to some of these buildings and offices.
Do you think the outcome of the commission will affect whether it gets onto SABC or not?
I don't think so. At the moment, you asked before, what do I think is going to happen with the commission? And it doesn't seem like much at the moment. It's not a complete whitewash, you know. There's some people are and already have been indirectly implicated, and they, you know, there's aspersions cast on them, and people look bad, they look incompetent, definitely incompetent in terms of from the police point of view. There seems to be some sort of there definitely has been collusion between lawmen, police, and state officials that really does look bad. But whether turning that into recommendations for charges of murder against some of these people, I don't think it's going to happen. We're going to find some very interesting stuff out of the report when these guys finally submit his report. But I don't think we're going to see any, you know, anything mind blowing. Not going to see any bombs drop there.
It is available on YouTube at the moment, isn't
it? It is.
I mean,
that's
the entire movie, not just the trailer.
No, the whole thing's up.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they put it up there or someone's getting technical with me as to how it got up there, but yeah, it's up there. So you can watch it if you just Google Miners Shot Down and check it out on YouTube.
Yeah, that'd be quite interesting. And, but again, obviously the accessibility is the issue, right?
Not many of us have the bandwidth to watch an 86 minute YouTube video. Yeah. You know, all the time. So, and especially if you've only got
an edge connection on a feature phone. For
that's
example,
right.
You know,
that's right. So and you can imagine the airtime you have to get on Vodacom to watch that.
Yeah. Greg, you attended the pro-Israel rally on Sunday, was it?
It was Sunday.
12,000 people at Linksfield Park.
That's right.
You had some interesting experiences just getting in to the rally, to be able to cover the rally.
To be honest, I was quite shocked. You know, this year, or if I think about the last year, some of the events I've attended with high security, I would think of the presidential inauguration, Zuma's inauguration this year, where we had a lot of heads of state from across the continent coming, and they went to the Union Building. So obviously security needed to be very tight for that. Then there's also the FNB Stadium Memorial for former President Nelson Mandela last year, where we also saw people like Obama. And
all the delegates flying in from overseas.
That's right. So some very, very high-profile people, you know, and so obviously you expect security to be very high there too, and it was. But I actually think the event in Linksfield had higher security than both of them. There wasn't the pre-screening as the sort of state events have, but let me describe what happened. I drive in, and you know, I thought it was just this, you know, random sort of support Israel event. Maybe a few hundred people would be there or something like that in Linksfield. I drive in, and there's some metro cops and cops on the street, and then you go in sort of to the car park, and then it's all these sort of private security guys, and they, you know, they weren't big and beefy or anything like that, but they were very well organized. Your car moves here, they sort of ask, "What are you doing here?" You get one tag. Car moves there, you know, you swap that for another tag. Eventually I got to the guy with the list and I told him I'm from the media, and he looked me up on the list, and I wasn't there because I hadn't RSVP'd, you know, as I rarely do. And he told me to turn away and go home. And I thought, oh, you know, I've driven to Linksfield. Man, can't you just let me in, please? Isn't there something we can do?
Show your press card, press credentials.
That's right. So he eventually said, okay, pull over there and we'll see if we can let you in. You know, we'll have some security guys come and speak to you.
So these are private security guys.
It's like private security. Yeah, that's right.
They're ex-Mossad guys.
Well, I wouldn't be. They had that feeling, and I was a bit intimidated too, you know. And so they come over and they're looking at my press card, and it's been through the wash. So it doesn't look so great. And I got accused of having a fake press card.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, it gets me into other events. So
there you go, dear listeners. Greg Nicholson does in fact wash.
So, you know, they look at that, and then they check out my passport, and they check out those things, and sort of ask me a few questions as to, you know, where do I live? Who do I live with? Oh, you live with your girlfriend. You know, what are you doing here? How long have you been in the country for? So what are you planning to report on here? And I'm saying, oh, the event, of course, but what do you plan to say? I was like, I have to listen to see what they say first. And then I'm a reporter. And then they say, but are you following the Gaza war? And I said, yeah, a bit. And they say, oh, so what do you think about it? I'm just thinking, like, what am I supposed to say to that? I was thinking, oh, war's bad. war's never good beyond that. You know, I'm just a South African journalist.
You say as you're hiding away your Palestinian scarf.
That's right.
Yeah. Out of view.
And then they fully search the car. Bomb squad comes over with a dog.
Wow.
They ask me a few more questions. And then finally, after this about 15-minute process, they wave me on my way to go inside the event. And the final comment was, don't incite our people. So I was thinking, Jesus, like, well, not Jesus,
not
you know, Jesus. Yeah, but
Jews for Jesus.
So yeah, it was rather intense, and yeah, so I was a little bit shocked. I was sort of a little bit shaken too. I got out of the car and had a cigarette and just looked around me like, what is going on? But the event was mainly attended by families of the Jewish community and other sort of supporting organizations like our supporters of the ACDP, IFP members, COPE members, which I think is quite interesting that these guys are supporting Israel. But But, and then we had,
so do you think that's maybe because the ANC has come out so strongly in favor of the pro-Palestinian movement?
I think partly. I also think, I'm not sure about this, but I wouldn't be surprised if different Israeli organizations or even perhaps the state works quite hard to build allies and to build support for Israel and to try and show them, some of the positives and counter the negatives for Israel. I wouldn't be, and I'm not sure what form that would take, but you do see some people traveling, like sort of Kenneth Moshoeshoe, the head of ACDP. He's been to Israel, and he talks about how it's not an apartheid state, and he continues to say, I've been to Israel, and it's much better than apartheid was, which he lived through. And so he's trying to play down the criticism that Israel is an apartheid state, just like South Africa was. And that's quite a damning criticism. So they're really trying to counter that, and they're using guys like Kenneth Moshoeshoe from the ACDP.
You mentioned earlier that, you know, this article you wrote, you know, just explaining your circumstances and what happened, just trying to get in there, got picked up by a lot of the pro-Palestinian propaganda movement that is quite a big movement in South Africa. It has a lot of support.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they'd be happy to be called a propaganda movement, but
they
do have some. There is a lot of support, and there is a lot of solidarity with the Palestinians. And I think that largely does come from, number one, the history of South Africa, and with the people being oppressed and being sort of marginalized to these areas and stuck there with, you know, sort of these borders when they have a claim to the larger land as well. They see the same thing going on in Israel and Palestine. So I think that really, really does sink in with a lot of South Africans. But then there's also one thing which I think is quite interesting too. It's quite in vogue to be a radical for Palestine. You see, if, you know, with the organizations like the PYA, universities and things like that, it is quite fashionable almost to be like a fighter or to be, you know, a comrade to support Palestine and to really, hate on Israel. It's quite popular. And that's one of the key defining characteristics of these young radicals and young upcoming, politicians. So I think a lot of people sort of jump on that. For both reasons, largely because of the oppression committed by Israel against the Palestinian people, but also because it's this sort of juicy topic that, you know, you're not cool if you're, you know, if you're not pro-Palestinian.
You mentioned to me that, you didn't turn down, but you're obviously quite busy, to be able to take and run with the story. And you know, a lot of media outlets were interested in interviewing you about your experiences with regards to the one that you mentioned at the rally. And, you know, I noticed a little bit of hesitation, you know, on your part in terms of getting involved, you know, beyond the story. I mean, you said what you had to do and you put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
But it did kind of strike a chord in that I've noticed a lot of media outlets are sort of somewhat tiptoeing around the issue, for fear of being labeled anti-Semitic on the one hand or Islamophobic on the other. And there's others where you can see the bias coming through, you know, either, you know, by virtue of birth, basically, you're either born on the Jewish side or you're born on the Palestinian side, the support side. And, you know, just by virtue of that, that's your stance. It's been chosen for you, you know, and I just find media coverage has been very difficult to find sort of unbiased report, even on sites like the BBC, for example, you know, that you would expect to be these huge multinational media organizations, upholding impartiality and all the good principles of journalism. And you can see even there a lot of the coverage that's coming through. I mean, it's a highly emotive issue. And I just, I struggle to find really good unbiased commentary on this. And it was just, you know, it's just you, when you mentioned that, it's something that, you know, reminded me of all the media issues behind this.
No, it's, I think getting involved in these issues is quite a minefield. And almost nowhere where you step is going to be safe. So I'm happy to go out there and do our work on these issues. If we have things to report on, if we have even analysis and commentary to do. That's, I think, important to try and do it as impartially and as objectively as possible. But then people often want you to go out and sort of say these things that you might have said in terms of our own work. And then they use that as a tip off for discussion, you know, which is quite common in the media. But it's also quite difficult to get involved in because there is, you don't know where people's biases lie. And with this sort of issue, it's so difficult to navigate and also be used as Greg Nicholson or you know, Steely or whoever we're talking about as a sort of a pinup for some of whoever's biases that they're trying to push. And I think it's around the whole world. Like you mentioned with the BBC, I haven't really been watching their coverage, but you see these very large media organizations around the world are both criticizing each other about being biased from either side. It's just a mess, I think. And it's so overwhelming. I think it just shows how overwhelming the Israel and Palestine issue is, as well as the broader Middle East and problems in the Middle East, because it is a real global thing. It's not just like here, or because we see solidarity with Palestine. We're quite involved in that, and these issues are really emotional. It goes around the whole world, and it's sort of almost everyone from every different background seems to have an opinion on it and seems to have a very strong emotional engagement with this topic.
One of the best pieces I've read on the matter was in the Huffington Post, and it was an atheist who actually wrote this, and I thought, you know, that's probably about the best place to start with, you know, find an atheist commenting on, and he was talking about the fact that, and you know, and he's of Pakistani descent, and you know, he was commenting on the fact, you know, people asking, are you pro-Israel, are you pro-Palestine? And it says, why do you have to be one or the other? Because you can, you know, the idea is that you're actually anti-human rights violation, right? It doesn't need to be that you need to be a supporter of one or the other. But that whole polarizing effect seems to be what's driving this 70-year-long feud.
And it's not a good way to conduct politics or engage in current affairs or extreme social issues like this one. I think... Well, one of the important things I've been noticing is some of the comments from the sort of human rights organizations and the United Nations. The United Nations seems to be sort of quite a bit more critical of Israel, but it won't let the Palestinian group Hamas off the hook either for firing rockets into Israel. But it's about sort of looking at the values that we believe and want to uphold as people, and I think most of those values, at least for me, sort of reflect things like the Constitution of South Africa and different bills of rights around the world. And it's about saying that whichever side we're on, the bombing of a school and killing school children, that's not okay. The indiscriminate killing of civilians, that's not okay. Firing rockets into, it is from Hamas side or Israel side, firing rockets at civilian areas, that's not okay. Blockading sort of a large population, a very dense population, and preventing them from getting access to general sort of things that we need to live is not okay. And it's about sort of upholding those values, and I think, and trying to hold on to them so that we don't sacrifice them, whichever situation we face, whether it be atrocities committed by America in Afghanistan or by the military junta in Myanmar. I think it's about having those values and applying them equally to every situation.
It almost seems that, you know, the fact that religion is at the center of this feud, makes it so much more emotive and so much more trickier to navigate, because, you know, you've got, you know, people go to war over religion, as we're seeing here now. And it just makes it a lot more harder to commentate on it, as part of the media, because you have such emotive issues and high, you know, high stakes involved here.
But I think it also goes beyond religion. So one of the interesting things, or the things I took away from Sunday's event from the South African Zionist Federation, was that that there was this real sort of that they, many people mention the history of persecution against the Jewish people, you know, dating back thousands of years, and up until more recently, and you know, things like the Holocaust, and how that's never going to happen again, how we can't let our people ever suffer through that again, and Israel as a nation will always be a place that's going to survive and a place of refuge. And we're never ever going to sacrifice that again. So I think it's sort of the religion mixed in with the nationalism, mixed in with the history of persecution, and then because of those things, a sort of almost blind allegiance or blind defense or a do whatever it takes attitude to protect ourselves. And I think that's so widely supported without sort of the questioning, or at least second, it comes as a second or third question. What are we doing to other people to really cement ourselves in this position and make sure that our people's safety will never, ever at all be sacrificed?
We've got Brooke Spector joining us on the line at the moment. Welcome, Brooks. Good afternoon to you.
Well, good afternoon, Stanley. How are you?
We're good, thanks. Have you recovered from the little tremor from earlier?
when we lived in Japan, we used to have our pots hanging on the wall, you know, on hooks.
Yeah.
And when they rattled, you figured, well, not a big deal. When they bumped into each other, you looked around and you said, hmm. When they started falling off the wall, you grabbed the cat and ran outside.
What happened to your pot this time, Bruce?
It just vibrated a little bit. Although it went on a long time. I counted about 30 seconds of this one.
Yeah.
And if Facebook postings are anything to go by, there are people who are claiming they felt it everywhere in the subcontinent from Botswana to Cape Town.
Wow. Well, that's pretty big.
Although I'm not a geologist for sure, but there are two basic types. There's the vertical earthquake that takes place way down below the surface of the earth, you know, in the mantle somewhere, and it has that violent shaking up and down feeling, like you're in an elevator that's been run by a berserk elevator operator. And the other one, the more horizontal one, that feels like the rolling of ocean waves, if you will. You're sitting in a little boat on big waves, and this was more the horizontal one, which tends to cover wide areas. I don't know about Botswana to Cape Town, but that's a lot of space. But I mean, it's possible you could feel something, even if it wasn't at the highest intensity. But I was looking at Facebook at the time, and message after message from people all over the place popped up. Some of them written, some of them badly misspelled. People were obviously very, very disconcerted.
Brooks, you've been following the U.S.-Africa summit that started today, right?
Well, it had its pre-summit meeting yesterday on Monday, which in many ways is one of the really big parts of it. The actual president-to-president meeting starts Tuesday, runs through tomorrow. But yesterday's meeting was what they call a ministerial level, that is trade ministers and economic ministers of various countries. And they were talking about the future of AGOA. Now, I mean, the moment you say AGOA, people's eyes glaze right over and they fall off chairs. But it stands for the African Growth and Opportunity Act. And for a lot of countries, it actually really does mean a great deal. What it does is it sets up duty-free export privileges, from Africa to the U.S. for thousands of different products. And it's U.S. law. It's not a treaty between countries. And this particular law has an expiration date, which is next year, 2015. And the issue to hand now is, broadly speaking, whether or not it will be renewed by the Congress, whether or not South Africa will continue to be a member of it, and whether or not there will be some sort of graduating principle. That is, if your economy gets too good, too big, too fast, too large, you get to graduate out of this preference and you're treated like any other country.
Were there any success stories for AGOA?
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, a lot of the exports from Africa to the U.S. are in the form of petroleum. So for a country like Nigeria or Angola, this is a big deal. But as U.S. imports of oil are going to start declining because of what they call energy independence, as oil, shale, and other resources are commercially exploited in the U.S., that will become a decreasing share of it. But of all the countries under the AGOA provisions, South Africa has actually been the big winner. The auto industry, automobiles and auto parts, something on the order of $2.3 billion worth of this stuff has been exported to the U.S. under AGOA, and that's a lot of cars. A lot of them are BMWs and Mercedes, obviously, but regardless, it depending on how you count this, something on the order of 60 to 70,000 jobs are directly related to it, and perhaps that number again in subsidiaries, subcontractors, and other people dependent on the industry itself. So if that provision disappears, that is the duty-free export, it becomes progressively harder to export those products to the U.S. because of cost implications. And so if you ask if there are any success stories, this country, more than most, actually, has been enormously successful under it. Also, Lesotho with textiles and clothing. A lot of those factories moved to Lesotho from South Africa, in fact, over the years, because of the wage differential. Lesotho, it's obviously a lot cheaper to run a factory in wage terms in Lesotho than it is in South Africa, but it's a much smaller volume of exports, obviously, because it's a much smaller industrial base.
What's the expectation for AGOA, Brooks? Is it likely to be renewed?
Well, let's put it this way. A vast majority of people in Congress, Democrats and Republicans both, have said over the years that they support its continuation. That's rather different than saying Congress will get to it in time to vote on it before it expires, to vote on a renewal, and to vote on a renewal under the precisely same terms that it's on now. And that's not necessarily a function of any antagonism to South Africa or to Africa generally, but simply that the snarl in Congress, the deadlock between Republicans and Democrats, is so intense and so unpleasant for many things that lots of perfectly anodyne measures get held up because the two parties and therefore the two houses of Congress simply can't come to agreement on things. And if that happens, a measure waits until they can finally reach a compromise on one thing or another, or until they finally get around to passing whatever bill is in front of them. It's not, remember, the U.S. Congress is not like, say, the South African Parliament, where there's an absolute lockstep between party and voting. In effect, every congressman, every senator in the U.S. Can and on occasion does act as if they are an independent party of one person, and they vote according to their own personal sense of what they think is the right thing to do, rather than follow orders from a party whip or a party head.
Brooks, you're talking to Greg here. I just want to ask, is there talk amongst the American politicians about tying, or is there any talk of tying this agreement to other sort of governance measures or development measures? Or, yeah, can you speak on that?
Yeah, AGOA already is.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you don't just because you're an African nation, you don't automatically become a beneficiary of this provision. There are certain forms of governance, rule of law and transparent minimal standards for transparency. So of all the African countries, I think currently 39 have been admitted to its principles. Madagascar was recently restored because of the final compromise election and transfer of government in recent months. But it's not automatic. Swaziland, for example, is no longer certified under AGOA because of a general perception that its governance is not in accord with rule of law. It's certainly not transparent, and there are a variety of people being arrested for one thing and another. And as a result, it's possible, although no one absolutely knows, because there's no current measure in front of Congress saying the following provisions apply and so forth. That hasn't even been written yet. It's possible that some of these governance and rule of law provisions will in fact be tightened, and that might well be consistent with the kind of discussion you're hearing in Washington now at this leader summit. So that does remain a possibility, in which case that number of 39 might actually decrease.
And
or the provisions might actually get better once you're a member, too.
And, Brooks, I've seen reports that there are protesters outside where these leaders are meeting. Can you tell us about that, and will it have any effect on the discussions?
Right, yeah, there have been several groups apparently protesting. I mean, any time you have the leadership of up to 50 countries from Africa together in basically one large room, there are going to be groups of disaffected people based in Washington or throughout the United States who feel very strongly about the way in which civil rights, human rights, civil liberties are protected or are not protected in any number of countries. And in fact, and I'm trying to remember which one it was, I have to look at notes, I think the protests were over Ethiopia in this particular case. They might well have been over Eritrea, except Eritrea wasn't invited in the first place, nor was Sudan, nor Zimbabwe, for that matter. And the Western Sahara didn't get to come either, because at least under American perceptions of the thing, Western Sahara doesn't constitute a country.
Brooks, in your article today, you mentioned that this summit could be viewed as a way for America to kind of prevent the ever-growing influence of the Chinese and the Indians on the continent. What are the objectives for America, you know, with regards to this conference?
Yeah, well, I mean, to mix my metaphors really badly, China's the very large invisible elephant clearly in the room. China's managed to have a similar kind of leader summit. I think they've had two, one in China, one in Africa, if I'm not mistaken. Japan's had one. Europe's had a variety of these things. Of course, the European one, Jacob Zuma didn't go to it last year, if I remember. The problem is that China's economic presence on this continent has grown enormously in the last decade. Much of that, however, has been the import into China of raw materials, whether it's oil or various minerals and metal ores from throughout the continent. And the investing is not quite the right word, the spending of large amounts of Chinese capital for infrastructure building in Africa. But the difference is that the way the Chinese economy or political economy is structured, the government can effectively tell a state bank and a state-owned enterprise or a quasi-state-owned enterprise, because there are all kinds of varieties of these things in China, to you go ahead and you make this investment and you do it without regard for the civil or human rights that pertain in the country that you're going to do it in. American government simply isn't able to tell a business, you go invest here even if it is on less than commercial terms. No government can do it, and no company would take that kind of order. So they are, to some considerable degree, dependent on businesses deciding it's in their interest to do it. But there is a lot of interest. General Electric just announced that over the next, next 5 years, they plan to invest $2 billion in Africa for electrical generating equipment and infrastructure. $2 billion, nothing to be sneezed at.
Will we see any of that money in South Africa, Brooks?
Well, it's not clear, but you probably will, if for no other reason that some of it will end up being staged from here or assembled from here or back office from here. There's also on the books, and apparently to be signed today, tomorrow, something close to $1 billion of other trade and investment deals. So that's a fairly significant total. The electrical generating equipment comes under the general rubric of a policy that was announced by Barack Obama previously, Power Africa, that stakes out six countries on the continent for massive infusions of help on electrical power generating. The thing of it is that that's not primarily government investment. That's the government leveraging investment guarantees or the underwriting of loans that private companies will do for their purposes, for their profit, for their interest in long-term investments on the continent. The real problem for the Obama administration in all this, of course, is it doesn't have a lot of money to throw around itself, and so it's got to work out all kinds of ways to leverage other companies' capital to make these things happen. Mm.
Brooks, before we let you go, I just want to, you mentioned the Obama administration just then, and I just want to ask you a question on a different topic. With the war in Gaza right now, and the U.S. involvement in trying to negotiate a ceasefire in different points, we've seen recently on the weekend when the Israeli Defense Forces bombed a UN school. There was quite a critical statement from I think it was someone in the White House, and we've also seen quite critical comments from Israel directed towards John Kerry. Now, can you tell us a bit about how this latest conflict might influence the relationship between Israel and the United States? Are these sort of criticisms just a hiccup?
Well, they're a symptom more than a hiccup, I think. If you were to look around the world for two allied countries whose leaders have a more toxic relationship than Benjamin Netanyahu and Barack Obama, I'll buy you lunch. because these two guys, you know, you'd really hate to be in the room with them together, because they clearly, they just don't get along, they don't like each other very much, and they don't seem to find a way to end each other's sentences, except in diametrically opposed ways. Having said that, the two countries, broadly speaking, are allied, and the vast preponderance of Americans, whether they're Democratic or Republican, whether they're Christian, Jewish, or atheist, for that matter, tend to think of themselves as America and Israel as similar kinds of democratic societies. Having said that, there are a growing number of people, and especially younger people, anybody under the age of, say, 40, young, relatively speaking, Greg, who are less inclined to give Israel the benefit of the doubt on these kinds of things than people would have, say, 10 years ago, or do people who are over the age of 40 because their memories and their feelings were formed some years ago about the issue. It's unlikely that the U.S. government would mount serious pressure on the Israelis to do any one particular thing one way or the other, if for no other reason that it's pretty clear the Israelis will do it anyway. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is to figure out a way to chivy them into moving in the direction that the U.S. government might like to see it happen. But as you notice, just a few days ago, a measure passed through Congress. I mean, it was a miracle. The United States Congress voted on something. Virtually everybody agreed to it, and it passed through quickly before they went out on summer recess, and that was to provide $220 million to help the Israelis resupply their Iron Dome anti-missile system. And it isn't, strictly speaking, a U.S. aid gift to Israel, because the Iron Dome system was actually primarily designed, developed, and researched by Israeli military scientists in the first place in a cooperative relationship with various companies and the U.S. military as well. But this is funding to help support it so that it can be restocked.
Just so all the listeners know, is the Iron Dome system being the one that's protecting Israel from most of the rockets from Hamas. But
that's right. It kept 2,000 some odd rockets from doing anything more than breaking up some house walls and ruining a lot of people's gardens.
That's right. Brooks, just before we let you go, we had a tweet come in that asked, what does J stand for in J. Brooks Spector?
Absolutely nothing. You can look at my passport, my birth certificate, and it stands for nothing. But when I was in the Army many, many years ago, the Army didn't believe that, and they, as the Army does, they made it a middle initial, so it became Brooks J. Spector, and I looked at this in my very sort of clever, too clever by half, 21-year-old self, and said, fine, you keep him, I'm going home. And their answer was, while you're in the Army, this is your name.
Brooks, before you go, I have one last question. Unfortunately, I do have to take it back to the Gaza conflict and Israel, because you mentioned not so much an aid package, but, you know, monetary support.
Yeah.
For the Iron Dome. And that's something that keeps coming up all the time, or quite regularly, is people point to the conflict in Syria and they go, look at the death toll in Syria. Why isn't there as much outrage about what's going on when, you know, it's a much, much bigger death toll over there compared to what's happening in Israel? Now, one of the reasons why I don't think we can actually compare the two is because, you know, the West isn't giving aid to Syria. You know, we've got the situation where America is providing assistance, has given billions of dollars in aid to Israel. And that's what the outrage, or part of the outrage is about, is that the West does have influence over Israel and could exert it, but isn't doing it to the extent people think, you know, should be done in order to effect some kind of peaceful resolution.
Yeah, well, first of all, the tragedy in Syria is an absolute unalloyed tragedy at this point. I mean, the number of deaths directly attributable to the civil war in Syria is two orders of magnitude larger than the body count in Gaza on this recent go-round. and the number of refugees streaming out of Syria or desperately trying to find someplace within the country or in Turkey and Jordan or even in Iraq, for goodness sake, is somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 million people, which is a huge chunk of the entire country's population. There is aid flowing into Syria to the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad from Russia. There is some small amount of aid going to some of the rebels in Syria from the U.S. and a number of the Gulf states. But the biggest body count and death toll in Syria now, of course, is the other group of rebels, the so-called ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, which is not being supplied by either the West or Russia or even the Persian Gulf states, to the best of my knowledge. The problem with Israel and the leverage that aid either does or doesn't have, as best I can tell, the Israelis would have done what they have done whether or not there was aid, whether or not there was leverage, in part because they see the rockets, they see the tunnels, they see all the rest of this as something close to what's usually called an existential threat to their existence. And, you know, when it gets that close to you, you feel you have no choice but, you know, to do whatever it is you're going to do. Whether their choice of policies in this case was right or wrong is a different kind of question, and whether the particular current government's obdurateness on trying to figure out how to achieve a larger settlement is right or wrong is yet another question. But I'm not absolutely convinced that there's this push the button and the Israelis will come to heel kind of relationship. I tend to think that the aid is there primarily because the two societies see eye to eye on their relationship and the politics of it flow from that rather than the other way around. But, I mean, that's my view, and I'm prepared to, you know, to have it corrected.
Yeah. Okay, Brooks, thanks very much for joining us today on the line. It's always a pleasure to speak to you. We'll very likely speak to you again next week. We're joined in studio now by an intern, Andrea, who's joining the Daily Maverick. Welcome, Andrea.
This is actually, I'd just like to point out, the first time we've met her. We haven't been to any other meetings. She's being introduced on air.
So this is how we roll at the Daily Maverick. It's sink or swim. This is what I mentioned yesterday. There's no pussyfooting around here.
Great. Well, yeah, thanks for having me.
Okay. Andrea's done a bit of stalking, and that's how you get an internship at Daily Maverick.
Also, you get a restraining order.
Yeah, a restraining order as well. You've been working on an interesting story I want to chat about very quickly. The story with regards to the refugees in South Africa who've been denied healthcare.
I think it is very interesting. I think there's sort of two facets to it, and the one is the policy itself. Or rather, there are a few policies which are involved, which is quite confusing. But basically, the new guidelines which came out last year in August, which require of refugees that they present their documentation before they receive treatment. Otherwise, they have to pay the full amount of whatever the treatment is up front. And there are some important caveats, like if there's an emergency situation or something like that, they're supposed to receive treatment regardless. The problem is, in a lot of hospitals, the policy hasn't been implemented consistently, and that may be in part due to the fact that the policy is quite confusing and in some ways contradicts other policies which are currently out there. What the various refugee centers and NGOs are seeing is a lot of refugees who haven't been able to get treatment, even though they've had emergency cases and they're legal as well.
So is it just bureaucracy, or is it something else that's holding this up?
I think that the hospitals are seriously overcrowded and undersourced, understaffed. And I think it's very convenient for them to have a sort of a quick fix, a way to deal with the problem, or at least to be seen to be doing something to deal with the problem. And I think, in truth, a lot of South Africans would not object to that, those sort of measures. And then, you know, guidelines which give them some kind of an authority can sort of authorize those decisions to turn away foreign patients who need treatment, I think, you know, that's convenient. I think the problem is that it's not actually the foreigners who are the source of the problem. It's more that the healthcare system just can't really keep up, you know, so they're looking for quick fixes, I think.
Did you do any investigation into the numbers of refugees in South Africa, the official count?
I don't know that, no.
Okay.
And I know that, like, Jesuit for Refugee Services are trying to get some stats on the number of patients who haven't been able to get healthcare. And this extends to pregnant women and women who come in with small children, people who need ARVs. I think it's just very difficult for them to measure. And they've only recently started trying to get a grasp of how big the situation is, how many people have been affected, and how many of these hospitals are supposedly implementing these guidelines, which aren't, which are still in a policy, a draft format.
What are these sort of refugee organizations doing to try and resolve the problem? Is there a plan?
I mean, there's actually a group called the Migrant Health Forum, which consists of Section 27, a refugee research unit under WITS, Lawyers for Human Rights, and a few others. And they've banded together to try and address the problem formally and have tried to engage the Department of Health and also various hospital CEOs on the matter. So I guess it's ongoing and probably for them to comment, but I don't think they've had a lot of impact.
Do you get the feeling that the part of the cause for this problem, at least in part, might be some sort of level of xenophobia or even unwillingness to deal with the problems of foreigners, especially sort of refugees or people who might be undocumented or those living in townships or places like Hillbrow? Is that a factor here?
Yeah, I think so. I would say almost definitely. And, a lot of the medical staff, just from personal accounts that I've heard, you know, treat the patients quite badly, just verbally, you know, why are you here using up our medicines? When are you going home? And as I said, you know, I don't know what the majority of poor South Africans who also need treatment think. I don't know. I think that xenophobic narrative is very common in those communities, you know, surrounding the hospitals. So, I don't know how much criticism it's really getting.
It's sort of amazing, this institutionalized xenophobia at different levels. I was speaking to some Metro cops at that EFF rally where they sort of got into fights with the EFF guys, and the Metro cops sort of were saying to me afterwards, they've got like, oh, damn these EFF guys. You know, they should stop fighting these issues. Instead, they should try and be kicking out the foreigners. You know, I don't care if the foreigners are from Serbia, Australia, or Zimbabwe. And I was just sort of nodding along, and I didn't say that I'm actually Australian. I just sort of nodded along, and, you know. But I think that's it for the Daily Maverick Show this week.
Yeah, that's it. We're wrapping up today. Thanks to Greg Nicholson in studio with us, and Andrea, thank you for joining us.
And welcome.
And for swimming.
Yeah.
You didn't
swim.
You swam. And to Brooke Spector, join us on the line. We're live every week at 1 o'clock on the Cliff Central Show, or you can catch us on the podcast.